Our next case, Peroza Benitez versus Smith et al. And Mr. Harold, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Tyson Harold, and I represent plaintiff Jose Antonio Peroza Benitez. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Done.
The facts of this case begin on October 8, 2015, when Reading police officers executed a warrant on Mr. Peroza's apartment in Reading, Pennsylvania. Initially fearing a break-in, Mr. Peroza exited his third-floor apartment onto the roof and fled to a nearby abandoned structure, where he crawled out a second-story window. While Mr. Peroza was hanging from the windowsill, Officer Hazer punched him 4 to 5 times in the head to stun and disorient him, causing him to fall, break his right leg, and hit his head, knocking him unconscious. At the time,
we're all up to speed on the facts of the case. Thank you, Mr. Harold. What I'd like to ask you is on the clearly established point, I think you'd acknowledge that there's no Supreme Court case or Third Circuit case that speaks to this particular fact situation, right?
Right.
Okay, so in order to be clearly established, we've said there can be a robust consensus of lower court cases. What in your mind, because clearly your position is there is a robust consensus, what are the cases that you think constitute that kind of robustness, or do you think it's beyond that? It's just, you don't need a case. It's just so obvious you can't punch somebody in the face when they're hanging two stories up. Or is it both? What's the main thrust for your position?
Your Honor, it's a mixture of it's kind of a hybrid case. We think that Tennessee versus Gardner in this case establishes general principles of law that a reasonable officer would know that you cannot punch somebody who's hanging out of a third floor window, which constitutes deadly force under the circumstances, where that person does not pose a threat to officers or others. In this case, Mr. Peroza did not pose any threat to officers. There were no bystanders in the vicinity. And Mr. Peroza was effectively boxed in at that point. There was no realistic chance that he'd be able to escape.
There was a call out that he was armed, that he had a gun. And in fact, there was a gun found later on the roof. Is it within the bounds of reason for the, you know, not to be flippant about this, but, you know, there's the famous Hans Gruber falling from the Nakatomi Tower scene where the guy's pulling a gun as he's falling. I mean, if he still had a gun, did he still pose a threat? And could the officers have been reasonably concerned about a threat, given that they had heard a call out about a gun?
No, Your Honor, because Officer Hazer testified that he knew that Mr. Peroza did not have a gun when he was hanging out the window. So even though there was a call about the Officer Hazer testified that based on what Mr. Peroza was wearing, which was just boxer shorts, he was able to assess that he did not have a weapon. And he was confident enough in that assessment to holster his own firearm and approach Mr. Peroza at the window. Officer Smith did the same thing, Officer Smith being in the room with Officer Hazer. And under the circumstances,
what about the risk to himself? Even if the officers realized he didn't have a firearm, holster their own weapons, and but he's hanging out the window. We have the Eighth Circuit decision in McKinney that there may be circumstances to subdue a defendant before they put themselves in harm's way, and here we have. Your client's testimony that even he recognizes that they were trying to pull him up into the window in the first instance. Why isn't that a fairly unusual situation? We don't have any analogy in the case law of officers who are trying to subdue a defendant in the heat of the moment in order to pull him up and out of harm's way.
Well, I don't think this is not an uplifted knife situation. The officers have the upper hand, literally and figuratively here. There's two officers in the window. Mr. Peroza is hanging from the window. The officers are wearing body armor, helmets, they have eye protection, they have gloves on. But I think that to answer the question about no exact previous factually analogous case law, the Third Circuit in Kopech versus Tate held that the Third Circuit takes a broad view of what constitutes clearly established rights that a reasonable official would know of, and that there does not have to be precise factual correspondence between a prior case and an instant case in order for a right to be clearly established. I think that the taser cases are the other part of this hybrid clearly established argument we're making, where there's like five or six cases where courts concluded that tasing someone anywhere between, I think some of the cases were 6 feet off the ground to 20, 25 feet off the ground, created a substantial risk to the person. So I think those cases are sufficient to put the officers on notice here. And I'll add that Officer Hazer knew that Mr. Perosa would injure himself if he fell. He testified that he knew that at the time that Mr. Perosa was hanging from the window. He also testified that he knew that if Officer Smith and himself let go of Mr. Perosa, that he would fall. And yet he punched him in the face four or five times to stun and disorient him, knowing that Mr. Perosa was slippery, that they're having trouble holding on to him, and then let him go and testify that his thinking was, screw it, if you want to fall, you're going to fall.
Well, you've noted the tasing cases, and let me just shift gears for a second and ask about Officer White, because there's a claim against Officer White as well. He is not in the position of Officer Hazer. He is not, as you said, able to look up close to see whether there's a weapon. He's heard that there's a weapon. Is he not acting within his right for self-protection, protection of fellow officers to deploy a taser when the individual may still be armed and his perception is that your client was moving after landing?
Sure, Your Honor. At summary, the court needs to view the facts in a light most favorable to Mr. Perosa. He testified that when he fell, he did not move. He testified that he was unconscious. And that's partially corroborated by some of the officer's testimony. Officer Eppolito testified that he didn't see any escape attempts after Mr. Perosa fell. Officer Eppolito being on the sidewalk, only feet from where Mr. Perosa fell. And Officer Perkins, Officer White himself, and Officer Smith all testified that Mr. Perosa never got to his feet. I think one thing that I want to correct is that Officer White was not in a very different position from Officer Hazer. He was below Mr. Perosa. That's clear. But
two stories below, right? I mean, there's a difference between holding somebody, like physical contact right next to him, literally, and being two stories below looking up.
Well, when Officer Hazer made his assessment about Mr. Perosa not being armed, he was not holding on to him. This is before he approached Mr. Perosa at the window. He made that assessment when he was on the other side of that second story room when Mr. Perosa was standing at the window trying to crawl out. And in this case, Officer White testified that at one point, before Mr. Perosa fell, he was directly beneath him. I think he estimated the distance to be about 10 feet. Which, Your Honor, I think is not that unlike the situation that Officer Hazer faced, and Officer Hazer was able to determine he didn't have a weapon. I think another telling fact in this case is that when Mr. Perosa initially crawled out the window, Officer White had his firearm out, but he was able to assess the situation and holstered his firearm and pulled out a taser, which suggests that he didn't think that Mr. Perosa did pose a threat to him, a threat of deadly force. Whether that's because he knew he didn't have a firearm or he didn't expect Mr. Perosa could or would be able to use it, it suggests that he didn't really think that his life or the life of other officers was in harm's way. And the Third Circuit in Russell versus Richardson, the Ninth Circuit in Brian McPherson, both held that it is unreasonable for officers to believe that somebody wearing only boxer shorts, that Mr. Perosa was wearing, could conceal a firearm on their person. So Officer Hazer's assessment of the situation, the fact that he holstered his firearm and the Russell case, I think suggests that a jury could find a reasonable officer in White's position would not think Mr. Perosa to be armed.
Okay, counsel, Officer White, is not able to see the other side of his body from standing on the ground as he's hanging out the window, right? And we have the audio files here that reflect this was rapid pace. All of this happens from the window to the fall to saying you got to call EMS within seconds. So given that and the undisputed facts that the tasing was immediately or almost immediately upon his fall, how could we say there's clearly established case law that would tell Officer White where someone has heard has a gun and may still have the gun, for a reasonable officer in that position, not to take action to subdue a potentially dangerous defendant?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a few facts here. The first is that Mr. Perroza had just fallen two stories. It's a material intervening event that a jury could conclude a reasonable officer would not think someone who just fallen two stories would want to or even be able to pull out a firearm. The other thing is Officer White was only feet from where Mr. Perroza fell. He didn't see a firearm in his hands when he was hanging from the window. And viewing the fact of Mr. Perroza not moving in a way most favorable to him, I think it's unreasonable for an officer to assume that Mr. Perroza could, if he didn't have a weapon in his hands, it would have to be in his waistband because he wasn't wearing any other clothes, that Mr. Perroza would have to reach down, pull out the firearm. He was on his back, so he'd have to turn around to Officer White and shoot him at that point. And meanwhile, there are four officers there. They're feet away. Two have tasers, one has a canine, and one has a rifle. If at any point Mr. Perroza had moved in a way that suggests he was trying to pull a firearm, it would have been reasonable to tase him. But he did not move, viewing the facts in the light most favorable to him.
So he didn't wait. And again, I mean, the record reflects that he was calling up that to let the taser know that he was there immediately below and ready to prevent escape. Doesn't all of that indicate that in terms of the timing of this, he was tased immediately, almost immediately upon falling? And what case says in a circumstance where potentially there's danger that an officer has to wait and see if there's a gun pulled on them or if the suspect is has the wherewithal to get up again and flee after a long chase like this?
Well, I think the cases where I understand there's cases out there that suggest that officers don't need to wait until a person's actually pointing a gun at officers to deploy force. But we weren't even close to that point in this situation. Mr. Perroza didn't have anything in his hands. He'd evinced no kind of force. He'd used no force against officers at that point, as all the officers testified. White testified he didn't see.
He managed to arm himself as he was running, or at least the unrebutted record is that somebody said he's got a gun, and they in fact found a gun later. So there's, when you say he posed no threat, at least for somebody like Officer White on the ground, not in the window, he's heard gun. Isn't that enough to put a reasonable officer at a level of concern where deploying non-lethal force like a taser is within the bounds of reasonableness, even if we look at the facts in the light most favorable to your client? No?
No, Your Honor. I think the fact that there were four officers there, there were plenty of personnel, two of the officers, one of the officers, again, they're feet away from him. So, I think what should have happened here is one or two of the officers should have approached Mr. Perroza and searched him and put him in handcuffs, taking him into custody. If he moved, they could have put him. But there were four officers there. You could have had two other officers as backup that were ready to tase him if he did move. And I think it's worth pointing out again that he just fell two stories onto a concrete stairwell. That's a significant fall. And so that's the material intervening circumstance, I think, that's dispositive here of why the force was excessive.
If I understand you correctly, if we accept the facts in the light most favorable to your client, he was unconscious. when he hit the ground and he was tased while being unconscious, correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Harrell. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Ms. Ambrose? You are still muted, Ms. Ambrose.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Tricia Ambrose on behalf of Officer Daniel White and Criminal Investigator Kevin Hazer. I wanted to start with the kind of a broader picture here and of what plaintiff's argument is or appellant's argument is. An appellant initially argues that the district court judge's decision is legally defective because she didn't determine prong one of qualified immunity. And I think towards the end of Harrell's argument, he kind of talked about whether the force used was reasonable. And that's not before the court. What's before the court is whether the officers violated a clearly established right of Mr. Perosa.
Yeah, right. And that argument hinges on, or should hinge on, whether or not we're operating on undisputed facts. Sounds to me, in reading this material, like we do have disputed facts. And since we do have disputed facts, we're obligated to take them on the face of the complaint, right? Mr. Harrell, and every reasonable inference. So if we do that, and you've got, in the case of officer, or you put it, investigator Hazer, we've got a guy who punches somebody in the face who is clearly not armed and who is in a life-threatening, precarious situation, and whose punches stun him and cause him to fall. That's the allegation. And an Officer White circumstance, somebody who approaches somebody who's just fallen two stories, sees them unconscious and tases them. If we take it on that level, Ms. Ambrose, what reasonable officer thinks those things are okay? I can punch somebody, make them fall two stories. I can tase them when they're unconscious on the ground.
Well, Your Honor, I would go back to Judge Krause's comments about what plaintiff did not dispute. And what he does not dispute is that the officers were trying to pull him in. They were attempting to bring him in. Mr. Perosa had at that point...
True, but let me interrupt you, because from the plaintiff's perspective, I take it they think that makes no difference at all. You could be really nice to me one minute, and then punch me in the face and make me fall two stories the next. And the fact that you offered me candy or you were good to me and helpful to me before doesn't really matter. What matters is, are you allowed to punch me in the face and make me fall two stories? And from their complaint, that's what happened. Officer Hazer loses patience, punches the guy 5-6 times in the face, and it causes him to fall. So what reasonable officer thinks I can make somebody fall two stories by punching him in the face? That's okay.
Well, Your Honor, there's no case that put officer or CI Hazer on notice that his stunning blows to Mr. Perosa were unreasonable. I think comparing his actions to that of a taser does not put him on notice.
Isn't the conduct so egregious? You really need a case. The guy's hanging from two stories up in his underwear and he's bleeding. And you even have the officer say words to the effect of, screw it, if you want to fall, we're just going to let you fall. You need a case telling the police officer you can't do that?
I think you do, Your Honor. The undisputed evidence is that they were not intending to punch him to have him fall two stories. There is no dispute they were trying to bring
him. Why isn't that a fact question? Why are we looking at their intent at this stage of things? And if we have to go to that, to extend relevant to a reasonable officer's assessment of the risk to Mr. Perosa, why aren't we right back to it being a jury question?
Well, because the facts are undisputed, and the fact of what they were attempting to do is undisputed, Your Honor. There has been no testimony that they were trying to push him from the window. They were attempting to bring him in. He was non-compliant. He was resisting, which he admitted to, and their attempt to bring him in with a stunning...
All true, but wait, That's all true, that they were trying to bring him in. How is that relevant to the objective assessment, not subjective, but the objective assessment of whether or not a reasonable officer would believe you can punch somebody in the face 5 to 6 times when they're hanging precariously from a second story window? How is the fact that a moment or two before you were attempting to be helpful, how does that affect the undisputed fact? Well, I'll take that back, because the number of punches is disputed, but we're going to take it as 5 to 6 punches in the face, because that's what's in the complaint. How do you get around that factual scenario and say, like, who knew that I could punch you in the face 6 times while you're hanging with your bloody slippery hands from the second story window and you would fall? Who knew? How does that work?
Your Honor, I think that's the point, is there's nothing that would have put Hazer on notice that was not unreasonable. He had an officer next to him holding on to him. They were trying to get him in to prevent harm to himself and further escape. This is very different.
Is it like the taser cases, Ms. Ambrose? Is it like those cases where they've said you can't tase somebody when they're on a third story ledge? You can't tase somebody when they're on a bridge and they might fall. If the aim and the professed aim was, I want to stun him, and a taser is to stun somebody, why isn't it precisely analogous? I can't do something to cause you to lose your senses when losing your senses might cause you to fall and injure yourself or kill yourself. Why isn't the punching in the face precisely analogous to a taser?
I don't think it's analogous, Your Honor, because in this situation, the officers were holding on to Mr. Perosa. He was not in standing over a ledge. He was not, not able to.
He was hanging from a window.
With two officers holding on to him, which I think is an important distinction, in that they had their hands on him. And when they realized they could not bring him in, that is when they let go. This
depends on how whether we think about what the officer is assessing as whether a reasonable officer would consider it appropriate to use a stunning blow that carried some risk in order to pull someone in the window to avoid the risk of harm, versus looking at simply whether a reasonable officer would understand that it violated his rights to use those stunning blows 2 stories up with the risk of serious injury as a result of the fall.
Your Honor, I think that the difference, as I've said here, is that the risk to Mr. Perosa was much less if they were able to bring him in, if they were able to get him in the window, and they were both holding on to him, they were both attempting to keep him inside. I mean, this is very different from the taser case. And I think if he had tased
him, hold on just a minute, Ms. Ambrose, because you keep saying they were trying to bring him in, they were holding on to him. Are we in a factual dispute area here? Because there was certainly a point, and Officer Hazer acknowledges it, where he said, as Judge Restrepo, who quoted him a little bit ago, screw it, you want to fall, you can fall. And is there not some room for a fact finder to be looking at this thing and saying those blows came at a time and in a way where they weren't securely holding him? This wasn't merely a stunning blow, this while they had him securely held. This was a frustration blow, and they weren't at that point securely holding him. I mean, aren't we looking at jury questions there?
We are, Your Honor, because the undisputed evidence from plaintiff himself is that they were holding on to me. He acknowledged that they were holding on to him, and they only let go when it was determined that they would not be able to bring him in. So I think
he doesn't agree to Right. And that at the point, it's not clear from the evidence, or maybe you can point us to where it is apparent that there's not a dispute about the sequence of the stunning blow versus when the decision was made to just let him fall.
As Your Honor noted, this was all rapidly evolving. I mean, this happened within seconds. I mean, Mr. Perosa.
Exactly.
So to expect criminal investigator Hazer at that moment to ascertain whether he was on notice that on this specific set of circumstances, he couldn't attempt stunning blows to bring him in, I think it's not a question that he would have been able to answer in that moment. If we were talking about a taser, if Mr. Perosa was standing at the window and was tased, we wouldn't be here before Your Honors. But this is a very factually specific situation that C.I. Hazer was not on notice that his actions in this rapidly evolving situation would have violated a clearly established constitutional right.
Why are those distinct? I mean, is there really some difference in the anticipated effect of multiple blows to the head versus a taser?
Well, I think they're distinct, Your Honor, because the taser cases are generally from at a distance. And like I said before, the plaintiff was being held on to. He was being held on. Presumably, if he was hanging from the window and not being held on to, he would have already fallen. And like I said,
not necessarily, right? I mean, he was holding on to the windowsill, and that's sort of the crucial question. You're saying it's undisputed that they were holding him while every punch was administered, or that they were holding him securely while every punch was administered. And the question is that a factual dispute or not? But shifting to Officer White for a minute, if we take the claim of the plaintiff, Mr. Perosa Benitez says, I was unconscious. I was not moving. I was unconscious. Is there anything in the law that would provide for a reasonable officer to think it's okay to tase people who are completely defenseless and unconscious?
No, Your Honor, and that's not the position we're taking. It's not our position that a use of a taser on someone that is unconscious is appropriate. But Officer White tased Mr. Perosa immediately upon falling. There is no evidence that he was aware that he was unconscious. At that point, he was a non-compliant.
No, there's a dispute. There's every reasonable inference has to be drawn in favor of Mr. Perosa Benitez. And his assertion is, I was unconscious. Now, you're making assertions about the timing. But once again, isn't that a factual dispute? His assertion is, I was laying there unconscious and he tased me. Your assertion is, no, it happened so fast, nobody knew you were unconscious. Shouldn't a jury look at the facts and decide who they believe?
Your Honor, that he was tased immediately. There's no dispute that there was any time went by. As soon as he fell, he was immediately tased. I don't dispute that he may have been unconscious, and the trial judge accepted that he was unconscious, but he was tased immediately upon falling. And at that point,
so your position is that it's a reasonable officer could think somebody who's just fallen two stories, you don't wait, you don't look to see, you don't check, you just can immediately tase. That's okay. Now, we're taking what you say are the undisputed facts. Undisputed that it happened instantaneously and there was no way to know that he was actually immobile. But even taking it in your way, you're saying that a reasonable officer would believe somebody who had fallen two stories, you can tase them instantly without knowing extent of injuries, whether they're even alive, you just tase them. And that it's not clearly established in the law that you shouldn't do that.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's the legal position, right?
That's the legal position. And taking into account, and I know Mr. Perosa has asked this court not to consider the entirety of the incident in determining qualified immunity. But we're not just talking about a gentleman who just fell from a window. We're talking about a gentleman who ran across rooftops, broke through glass into an abandoned building, at some point was armed, and had jumped out a window in an attempt to continue to flee police. I mean, Mr. Perosa had made it clear that he was non-compliant and would attempt to resist arrest. And based on those facts, it was not clearly established that Officer White, using the taser for one round immediately upon him falling in an attempt to gain compliance, was violated clearly established right.
Counsel, we're talking here about a drop of 10 feet. Would the government's position be different if what we had was a drop of 50 feet?
Might be, Your Honor. It could be. I mean, this was a second story window. It was a fall. But I mean, there was no reason to think that just because he fell, he was then going to become compliant. I would also note that he fell in front of an open breezeway, which would have provided another means of escape for Mr. Perosa.
Open breezeway. He fell onto concrete steps going down to a basement, right?
There was an open breezeway in front of him, Your Honor.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Ambrose, for your argument. Mr. Harold will have your rebuttal, sir.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. One thing I just want to tell you is I'm not so sure it's clear that the fall was only 10 feet. We attached the exhibit pictures of the fall, so Your Honors can see that. But this wasn't, we want to be clear, it was a second story window, but it wasn't a second story window onto ground level. The stairs led down to, as Your Honor mentioned, a basement or a breezeway. So we're really talking about, I would say, more than a story and a half at this point. This is an old row home, so it's a pretty significant fall. And also point out that Officer Hayter knew how high that was. He went into 952 Elm Street through the front of the building. He saw the breezeway, he saw the stairs, he saw the porch, he saw everything that was there that could have been a hazard. And even saw it when he was engaged with Mr. Perosa at the window. He said he looked down and saw the porch. So we saw all of that.
Start with where Ms. Ambrose ended with Officer White, that this is all happening instantaneously after a high speed chase with a guy he believes is armed, who's resisting arrest at every step, and that and aggressively resisting arrest. Doesn't that all play into this circumstance, and which is not disputed, that a reasonable officer could believe, I need to immobilize this person immediately. They're fleeing, they're aggressive, they're actually potentially armed and dangerous, and I got to stop them.
Sure. Well, I don't think this is happening as quickly as counsel for the defendants make it sound. I mean, Officer Hayter testified that, I think he testified that there was about a minute interaction when Mr. Perosa went out the window and Officer Hayter was in the room with him. We know that Officer White had time.
I'm just talking about Officer White now, and Officer White, and it stands to reason that even on your set of facts, that this is unrebutted because your client is unconscious by your account. That the position that we're getting from the other side is it happened immediately. He hit the ground and they tased him. White tased him. What if we assume that's true, so that White doesn't know, oh, he's unconscious? Your legal position has to be you can't tase, you have to wait and see whether he's going to get up and pull a gun, or see whether he's going to get up and try to run. You can't immediately try to immobilize the person who has been fleeing and aggressively fighting the police. Is that right?
Sure, Your Honor. Yeah, but I think the important thing to note is it's not a situation where he was fleeing and, you know, maybe slipped and there was a split second where he was lying down. I want to emphasize that he had just fallen two stories. And I want to emphasize again, there were four officers there. So only feet away from where he fell. So we're not asking, you know, the officers to wait and see if he's going to pull out a gun. What we're suggesting is what should have happened is with four officers there, one or two of the officers should have walked the 3 feet. I mean, they testified they were 3 to 5 feet away from him when he fell. So one or two of the officers should have immediately gone to him and secured his hands while the other officers were there to kind of keep an eye on him with their own force options if he actually did anything.
Mr. Hill,
those all might have been better things. I'm sorry, go ahead. They all might have been better things, but that's not the standard.
Well, I think Officer White testified the situation was under control at that point. And again, I think I need to emphasize, he did put his service pistol away and took out his taser. So I'm not really sure that, I don't think a reasonable officer would believe him to be armed based on his attire, but I'm not so sure that Officer White even believed that. And he actually didn't say he believed he was armed. He said that he assessed that he was capable of possessing a firearm, which I think is belied by the Russell versus Richardson case.
Is there any dispute about the authenticity of the audio file being in real time?
No, Your Honor, we don't dispute the authenticity of those recordings. What we do dispute, though, is whether Mr. Proza did have a firearm on the roof. But I think for purposes of this case, it really doesn't matter because for two reasons. First of all, because of the radio call. So whether or not he had one of the officers said he did. But more importantly than that, by the time he was at the window, it was clear to Officer Hazer he was unarmed, and it should have been clear to a reasonable officer in White's shoes that he was unarmed.
And can you clarify, because the audio recording seems to be comprised of small segments, but it runs continuously. Is that all in real time? Does that tell us from beginning to end without a gap? That's the full recording from the initiation of the incident to EMS.
I'm not sure if it's a full recording of the whole incident. I seem to recall that it was only
recorded. Sorry, can you say that again? There was interference.
Sure. I seem to recall that the recording was only. The call was only recorded when the officers actually used their radios, which would mean that we only have a recording of when it was picking up sound. I don't know if it was. I don't believe it was during the whole. I mean, the whole incident was 9 minutes long. We know that because the officers testified that they got there at 6:40 in the morning. They executed the warrant at 6:40, and we have, this is in the record. We have the taser record or taser printout. It was deployed at 6:49. So we know it's 9 minutes. I don't think it's the whole time.
I'm going back to Officer Hazer. What can you point us to as clearly establishing for a reasonable officer that the use of stunning blows to the head in connection with an effort to pull someone back out of harm's way is unreasonable? If we think of that being what's at issue here.
Sure, and we don't have any case law suggesting that punching somebody, much less punching someone while trying to pull them back in a window, I want to be clear, factually analogous case law suggesting that is illegal. I can only imagine that this doesn't happen very often. The taser cases seem to be, that's usually what officers seem to use when a person's at an elevated location. But I think it is disputed at the time that Officer Hazer punched him, whether or not they were still holding on to him. Mr. Proza.
Does even the qualified immunity question there's a factual determination that needs to be made as to at what point in the sequence there were the blows to his head?
Yes, absolutely. The court can't decide the qualified immunity issue because of those disputed facts. But I would add that I think it would be unreasonable even if they were holding on to him, given that he was slippery, given that he was hanging out a window. I think under the circumstances, punching somebody only to then let go of them is just unreasonable. And I think that's clearly established by Tennessee versus Gardner and the taser cases.
So I understand your argument that it's just obvious, but we've also been cautioned against taking too broad a view of a Gardner and just what's unreasonable. The other cases that you've cited to us seem to be unpublished cases and cases from district courts. Where is the robust consensus of the type of authority we'd normally for clearly established in terms of precedential Court of Appeals decisions, if not Supreme Court decisions, that would inform a reasonable officer that their actions were unconstitutional in this context?
Sure. The Third Circuit in Fields versus the City of Philadelphia said that that district court decisions do play a role in clearly established law. We just don't have Third Circuit or Supreme Court cases directly saying that punching somebody that's hanging out a window violates clearly established law. But I would just argue that I don't think, you know, I'll point the court to the Seventh Circuit case in Phillips versus Community Insurance Corporation, where the court said, quote, every time the police employ a new weapon, officers do not get a free pass to use it in any manner until a case from the Supreme Court or from this circuit involving that particular weapon is decided. And also to Kopech versus Tate, where the court said, Third Circuit said that the Third Circuit takes a broad view of what constitutes clearly established law.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Harold, and thank you, Ms. Ambrose. We've got the case under advisement.